Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. My childhood vacations, for me, growing up in Los Angeles, usually meant a prop plane ride to New York to see my grandmother in Brooklyn. But one of the really greatest excitements for me as a child being in Manhattan was getting to eat at the Horn and Hardart Automat, where beautiful slices of lemon meringue pie beckoned from behind those little windows. So I was very happy to see that history so handily examined in William Grimes' beautiful new book, Appetite City, A Culinary History of New York. William Grimes was the restaurant critic of the New York Times from 1999 to 2003, and in his new book he takes us on a grand historical tour of New York's dining culture, from 19th century chop houses and oyster bars to Cafe Sabarsky and Windows on the World. He tells us about the Delmonico brothers, who opened a simple cafe in 1827, and he illuminates the impact of gender, class, and social climate of the city on culinary culture. Tonight, Mr. Grimes is joined by our hometown Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic, Jonathan Gold, for a bicultural binge, as we're calling it. Maybe we think of it as Edith Wharton on Madison Square versus Bukowski at Musso and Frank's. I'm not sure. It's a two-city tour of restaurant history. The length of histories may be a little bit skewed, and it is going to be moderated by noted restaurateur and cookbook author Evan Kleiman. And then, for a last announcement, if you're hungry after tonight's program, you can either hit the pop-up taco stand, which is really great, at 3rd and Beaudry, or you could head over to Cafe Pinot. Tonight they're inaugurating a special, it's called Allowed in the Kitchen menu for Allowed patrons. It's a prefix meal. It's a great deal, and they'll be doing a different menu every Thursday night, so you might want to check that out. So for now, please welcome Jonathan Gold, William Grimes, and Evan Kleiman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. Preparing for this conversation was very interesting for me. It sort of made me realize how much I don't know about my own city. And I also started to realize that it's a conversation that if we go back far enough, it really is about comparing apples and oranges in a really big way. Just to put it a little bit into context, in 1781, when Los Angeles was founded, it was still Mexico, and New York was founded as New Amsterdam 129 years before. So the whole paradigm sort of this very tight urban center of not much space and a lot of people, and this wide open frontier, empty for a really long time, I think has informed a lot of the history of both places. So that being said, I want to start a little bit by asking Biff to talk a little bit about that really, really early history and what started first. The very, very low end, the very, very high end, and how markets, the Fulton Market, the Washington Market, started to really drive what happened at the beginning of the history of New York restaurants.
Well, at the beginning, and we're talking about the 1820s here, just as the Erie Canal was getting ready to open, and that would be the big transformative event economically for New York to really propel it into being a major international economic center. We're talking about, you could get food outside the home, and there were places where you could get catered. You could send a servant over and get some food sent to bring back home. There were boarding houses that served at various economic levels. But it was there were no restaurants. And if you were well-to-do, you ate at home. The restaurant is, if a restaurant is a place where you go and you can order a meal at a time of your choosing and be waited upon and have a menu, New York didn't have it. And in 1827, that's when these three clever brothers from Switzerland by the name of Delmonico opened a little cafe with a few rickety tables and put some pastries out and started serving liqueurs. And that was, in retrospect, the Big Bang. That was the beginning of this glorious thing that we know today as New York, the restaurant capital of the universe, as it fancies itself, you know. Well, certainly a city with a lot of restaurants. That's indisputable. And it was a transforming event because they were bringing a little note of foreign sophistication to a city that didn't have much of it. And it was at a time when the city was about to get not just waves of poor immigrants, but well-to-do immigrants, businessmen, traders, who constituted a market for this kind of thing. And homegrown, you had people coming from the hinterlands to New York who needed a place to eat, and some of them who had more money or coming from more well-to-do families and studying at college and so on. Like the fellow I have in my first chapter, a guy named Sam Ward, who was later a crooked political character. He was so excited that Delmonico's was around because he and his buddies would go down and they could feel like they were living the life of gay Paris and right there in New York. So that was the seminal event, and from that, after that, came everything.
Was there a Delmonico's here?
Not in the 1820s, I don't believe.
Frontier town.
Unless you counted, you know, people who killed a cow and invited all their friends over to eat it. That's good, too.
Yeah, I mean, at that time, actually, Los Angeles was considered the queen of the cow counties. And we were known for the massive herds here that fed all the miners.
It was excellent cattle country.
Yep.
I mean, I think the city slogan of Bellflower is still where a cow is queen.
So given that a lot of this conversation is going to have this sort of bifurcation of time, of temporality... When here did something like a Delmonico's occur that where people of means could no longer, they could eat somewhere else besides home. They could go out and they could have something that resembled, you know, a restaurant meal.
Well, let me read my favorite quote on LA restaurants from the 30s from S.J. Perlman in an essay called Farewell, My Lovely Avocado. Okay. Since I had forgotten to bring along a bag of pemmican, I would have to eat in Los Angeles. A fairly exact definition of the kiss of death.
And this is the 1930s?
I believe it is, yes.
And in the 1930s, New York was... Give me a snapshot.
Oh, well, it wasn't so great in New York in the 1930s. If you think about it, it was bread lines, and the Depression had an iron grip on the city, and you had a penny restaurants that a crazy guy named Bernard McFadden, he was a physical culturist who made his money off these magazines where people, you know, did muscle poses. And
he wasn't originally from California?
I know he wasn't, but, you know, there's definite overlap in some sort of way, but he had this idea for doing penny restaurants, and you could, in the depths of the Depression, actually get dishes for a penny. There were fancy restaurants, too, and there was the Automat, of course. The Automat got started much earlier. At 1903 was the first Automat in New York. But I think of the 30s as sort of the age of the popular dining format, much more than there were the occasional... high-end former speakeasies that were transmuting into snooty restaurants like the Colony or the 21 Club, and those were certainly around, present and accounted for, but really how many people could afford to eat at those sorts of places.
And I guess that would be the period of time of Clifton's. I mean, I think of the penny meal.
At Clifton's, or pay what you wish, which was their motto for a very long time. He actually found that he was getting more money than he was when he put actual prices on his. so it worked out for him, even in the depths of the Depression. But, you know, there were also places in the 30s in Los Angeles, like Tomaine Tommy's, which was in Highland Park and was famous for inventing the chili size, which is used to be a hamburger patty on a bun with lots of chili on it. Good value for your nickel.
And in those days, I mean, geographically, L.A. was still very balkanized. So Tomaine Tommy's was mainly a place for people who lived right there.
Actually, it wasn't. The interesting thing about looking at lists of restaurants from the 30s and 40s and 50s is just how geographically diverse there are. There are restaurants in Inglewood that were considered among the restaurants that people went to. There were restaurants down in Westchester. There were restaurants in the Far Valley. I think when we didn't have traffic that was what it is now, you could actually drive to Westchester from Hollywood, and it seemed reasonable.
I want to talk a little bit about the paradigm of markets and city, which now is just informing everything.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about it, what it was at the beginning, the development of those markets and what they meant for the city and the food system, how it worked, things coming into New York.
Well, this is a huge revelation for me because, like so many other people in New York, I had always thought of the Fulton Fish Market as being sort of the big New York market. Today, there's the Union Square Green Market, and everybody's all excited about that. Well, that is like a postage stamp compared to the size of the old Fulton Market that got started in the 1820s. And on the west side, there was a market of comparable size, the Washington Market, which survived into the 70s when the World Trade Center swept it away. And these markets were cities within the city. They were little worlds unto themselves, and there were thousands, literally thousands of stalls, these purveyors of produce, of game, of meat, of fish. Both rivers would just be solid traffic of ships coming in, bringing oysters, fresh fish. There would be cattle drives from Pennsylvania, and we had cattle too. cattle drives from Pennsylvania and Ohio, and these would be barged across the river. The night before, there'd be this lineup of these almost an assembled army. This is like, you know, epic scale. Assembled armies of farmers bringing produce from the lower New York counties and New Jersey and Long Island, and they would just pour across the Hudson and the East River and into these markets. And where these instantly the demand was just over. Demand exceeded supply. It was the city just was growing by leaps and bounds, and these markets became not just food centers, but you could buy shoelaces or used books. And inevitably, there would be food stalls, and from these food stalls developed some of the greatest restaurants in the city, particularly oyster restaurants. So they were, to get in there, once you got in the little warrens and cubbyholes and the maze of these things, you could just, you could spend all day in there and never find your way out.
And for us, the farmers market at 3rd and Fairfax, which started 75 years ago,
right,
started with 18 farmers.
Which is probably about how many there are now. Unless you count Nordstrom's. And of course, Los Angeles is the basically, if not the actual home, the spiritual home of the supermarket, which the first supermarket, I think, it was Vaughn's next door to where the Mexican place El Parian is now on Pico. And it was a miraculous thing to be able to go in and to be able to, you know, pick out your own meat and vegetables and cereal rather than standing behind a counter and having somebody go back and get it for you.
That whole thing about how our history just seems so much more casual and do-it-yourself than the New York way of more formality being served is I find really interesting, and I'm wondering if it just has to do with space and distance, and we had more Calvinists out here. Mm-hmm. I don't know, the whole movement of Pentecostalists and health people, whether that sort of informed us more than pleasure, pure pleasure, of which New York seems very much driven by in terms of the restaurant scene. What do you think about that?
Well, this is a new one on me, that California is not driven by pleasure and New York is. I mean, I always thought pain was the big impetus in New York. You know? Self-inflicted by others, and just, oh, you know, in an endless loop. And you never get out of it.
It's because you live in Queens, I think.
God's country, as I prefer to think of it. The New York, I think the hallmarks of these markets and of the New York restaurant scene generally, and of New York culture generally, is just this grasping, striving, endless, perpetual motion is very exhilarating when you're in the midst of it. And I think the markets epitomize that, and the restaurants in general. I mean, the synergy between theaters and restaurants, for example, is just one of these really dynamic engines of growth and pleasure in New York. In fact, when you would go through the Fulton Market, a lot of the traffic was foot traffic to the Brooklyn Ferry. People had been to the theater, they were going through the market, and they would have a late-night dinner at the oyster stalls, and then they would get the ferry back to Brooklyn, and that was a big night out. But all up and down the island, wherever there were theaters, there was going to be a chop house attached to it, like a barnacle, and there was going to be an oyster cellar, and perhaps two or three, a big German restaurant, because German cuisine was huge in New York, starting in the 1840s and until the First World War, really. So you had this cross-currents of foot traffic and appetite between theaters and restaurants, and it gave a certain dynamism to the life of the street life of the city.
And that certainly is true for us, too, how entertainment drove a certain kind of restaurant. I mean, Musso and Frank's was remade in the 30s so that there could be a separate room for celebrities.
Yeah, which was closed off for many years. The other room, the room without the celebrities, is the one with the mural. So that's
which is sort of nice.
And I, from what you were saying before, I don't think Los Angeles is necessarily anhedonic. I think we're as driven by pleasure as the next city, maybe more. But the difference in development, I think, is that Los Angeles has always been, you know, a middle-class paradise, that it's always been about home ownership, that it's always been spread out, that people didn't necessarily have servants, and that the carriage trade, such as it was, you know, they may have gone out to to Ciro's or to the Trocadero or to the nightclub restaurants when they wanted a huge evening out, but I think they've always tended to entertain at home. And that hasn't necessarily been the case in New York, where the homes tend to be a bit less lavish.
Yeah, there was, I mean, space, geography and has its iron laws and real estate, and those things conspire in New York to force people onto the street and out of their apartments, particularly in the days before radio. Cooking facilities at home were usually very restricted. I was interested in reading. Theodore Dreiser lived in the Village for a number of years, and he kept diaries, and I was interested in them. I'm a big fan of him as a writer, but also as a diner, because he would tend to talk about, well, you know, he got up and he went to the child's cafeteria or the child's luncheonette for breakfast. You know, three meals a day he would eat out, and I think a lot of people did, all these bohemians in the Village. They rarely cooked at home, and today, of course, the counterpart of that is just this constant Chinese takeout culture that you see in Seinfeld, mm-hmm. television shows like that. But, you know, I know people who keep books in their ovens. And And we'll, without shame, we'll say they have never lit a burner, and which appalls me. But there you have it. And that's money in the pocket of anybody who runs a cafeteria or a lunchroom or a restaurant.
So let's talk a little bit about influence and where it came from in New York, the influence of the Swiss and the French.
Well, yeah, the waves of immigration are not, you know, when we talk of ethnic cuisine today, let's eat ethnic in New York. Well, in 1870, let's eat ethnic meant let's eat Italian, German, or French. And the Times actually had an article, kind of a guide to these rather inexpensive restaurants where you could encounter these exotic cuisines, and it warned readers that they may encounter these really awful cooking smells that they'd never had to deal with before, but if you kind of got past that, you could actually get this stuff down, and it was the food was actually decent. You know, Italian food, what do you have to get past? I could make, garlic, I guess, is what they're talking yeah. about, but they wouldn't come out and say it. And that little triumvirate, French, Italian, German, gave way to toward the end of the century, toward, you know, a thousand flowers bloomed. I mean, we finally got a Chinatown in the 1880s, much later than in California. But by the 1880s, there were five or six restaurants in Chinatown, and they were attracting diners from all over the place. New Yorkers tended to catch on to things pretty quickly, and secrets didn't stay secret for long. So these Chinese restaurateurs were just astonished to see people in bowler hats eating at their restaurants. Syrian cuisine came along, and that clustered around the Washington Market. One immigrant group gave way to the next. The French Soho used to be a French neighborhood in New York, and it gave way to the Italians, who opened their boarding houses and restaurants there, and then, you know, they were superseded by the next waves. And now, of course, it's all Latin American and Asian, pushing all those cuisines to the side as well. So huge numbers coming through New York, and each wave of big numbers changed the equation in dining in the city.
When you start talking about fine dining, was there a moment where there became a definable American cuisine?
Well, you know, if you think about it, remember the Four Seasons in 1959. That was the first, what I would call, self-conscious exercise in creating an haute American restaurant. It was the first self-consciously modern restaurant in a lot of ways, and the whole point of it for Joe Baum was his little statement that we are Americans, we are not French. And it had been thought up to that time, if you opened a fine, an expensive restaurant, well, that restaurant had to be French to have any legitimacy. So what he was opening was the anti-pavillon, which was the benchmark French restaurant from 1940 until Henri Soulet died in the mid-60s. And it represented sort of both the best and the worst about France and its cuisine as interpreted in the United States. That it was, there's a good book called The Last Days of Haute Cuisine, and there's a witty sort of formulation of this, was that in the 60s and 70s you had a choice between the sort of the brown leather and red velvet. You could either have these old big stolid steakhouses or these fussy old French restaurants with the red banquettes, and the dining scene was sort of crying out for something different. And Joe gave it.
Well, it's interesting when you look at the menus of the old Delmonico's. Maybe to me it's just the variety of game, but it doesn't seem French. It seems American.
Well, it was they adapted. I mean, if you look at this Bible size cookbook that the big chef there, Charles Ronhoeffer, put out in 1894, called The Epicurean, which you can don't run out and buy it, you can just look at it online nowadays. All 1500 pages of it. But yeah, there are things in there like jambalaya and. The first thing that does catch your eye is this enormous quantity of game that came over from the wetlands of New Jersey, and you know, woodcock, plover, and snipe. But he was one of these. A lot of these French chefs who came over tried to do classic French cuisine, classic French sauces, and then they got curious, and then they started noticing these ingredients. There's a moment in Jeremiah Towers' memoirs where he talks about this crystallizing moment for him was when he saw this corn soup a la Mendocino in the Epicurean. And he thought, whoa, what's going on here? How did this guy in 1894 happen to look over to California and think of this regional identity and then want to incorporate it into this biblical cookbook? And it got his mind to working on the idea of regional cuisine in the United States.
So even California cuisine comes from New York?
Sure. Yeah, I guess all roads lead to Rome.
Though it's interesting looking at, you know, Escoffier from almost the same period, that there's that recipe for chicken a la Maryland in there that I don't think anybody from Maryland has ever actually eaten.
Mm-hmm. I'm still trying to work out the Mendocino, what made it Mendocino, but maybe someone can explain that to me.
There's not much corn grown there.
But it was a hotbed of Bohemians.
It was kind of a shrimp corn soup.
Yes, but it was a hotbed of Bohemians, so maybe that's the connection.
Mm-hmm. I mean, an interesting thing in Los Angeles that doesn't exist in New York, as far as I can tell, those Keene's Chop House is certainly antique in its own way, is the Musso and Frank Grill here in Hollywood. You know, has the, you know, the biggest sign, that the giant sign, you know, oldest restaurant in Hollywood, established 1917. To which some English actor is reputed to have, like, looked at, sniffed, and said, "It takes us that long to train our waiters." but the menu is absolutely antique, early century America. I mean, you have your avocado cocktails, and you have your jellied consommé, and you have your Finn and Hattie, and you have
your mushy spaghetti bolognese.
Shrimp louie. Yet they've always had a big sign in the restaurant. It's always been on every time, "Our chef from Paris, France."
Yes, from Paris, France. So given that New York was so, the high level of dining was so influenced by France, when our high level of fine dining started, which would be in what years? The 40s? 30s, 40s, 50s, the 80s.
I mean, what would you call fine dining in Los Angeles? Like for example,
Perino's and Chasen's and.
Well, Chasen's was in the late 30s, I think. Was started by, you know, this guy Dave Cook, who was sort of a straight man in vaudeville acts, and was staked to a restaurant by Harold Ross, who started the New Yorker. And it opened as a place, as a chili house. And it became a very famous and very fancy chili house, but it didn't start as a fine dining restaurant, which was interesting.
And Perino's?
And Perino's. A lot of restaurants in LA have been started by Italians. Except for La Scala, which was started by a Spanish guy who used to work at Le Pavillon, but that's another story.
Wow, I didn't know the reach was that extensive.
He came up with the chopped salad, I think, or that particular Italian chopped salad. But you look at, like, a lot of the dishes from Los Angeles had a certain amount of reach, like, you know, the Brown Derby with its Cobb salad, which was on every menu and in America at some point.
The
Caesar salad, which, I mean, anybody of a certain age in Los Angeles remembers, like, you know, right down the street from Kittyland, was Cardini's, where Caesar Cardini came up from Tijuana about 5 minutes after having invented this at his restaurant down there. I mean, this was probably not the time to talk about McDonald's, is it?
Well, I mean, actually, it's interesting because when you start reading about the history of dining in Los Angeles, one of the things that strikes you is that fast food definitely started with Orange Julius, was the first guy to do a franchisable operation that then swept Taco Bell, Wiener Schnitzel,
Bob's Big Boy,
Panda Express, which is here in the library.
Carl's Jr., yeah.
In-N-Out and McDonald's.
Well, there's always been that thing with Los Angeles because of Hollywood, because because of the recording industry, and because in a large way we're the center of a huge part of the world's culture, that things from Los Angeles don't necessarily seem as if they're from Los Angeles. They seem as if they're American. Just in the way that people don't necessarily recognize the Los Angeles accent as a Los Angeles accent, they recognize it as what they hear their local newscaster doing. And I think a lot of that came through with the food. I mean, what we thought of as California cuisine for a huge amount of time was, Dad's cooking, the stuff that was in Sunset Magazine of, men in check shirts on redwood decks, barbecuing everything but the salad and sometimes that. and the influence of that went right into, I would submit, restaurants like Spago, which took the sort of cooking that we all found familiar, fused it with some very sophisticated, European cooking and Asian cooking, and came out with the hybrid that is as close to the heart of new American cuisine as anything is.
Yeah, I mean, this is where California came to the rescue for New York, which had just run out of gas in the 70s. And was
to give us a little snapshot of what was there in the 70s.
Well, as I referred to, I was talking about before about these kind of heavy, gloomy steakhouses and worn out, old fashioned French restaurants. Those kind of French restaurants that on the Lucy show they would go to, and the maitre d' would make them feel. Have his nose in the air, and the menu hadn't changed in 40 years, and it was just a sort of temple of snobbishness, and nothing was happening in the kitchen that was of really any interest anymore. And the city itself was fraying. I mean, the whole, at the close of the Second World War, New York looked like it was on its way to becoming Oz. I mean, it was the great social experiment that was working in every way. It was abstract expressionism was at its getting going, and the museums were great, and the jazz was great. The social policies were great, and that public housing was great, and this was the city of the future. Well, by the 70s, it was going bankrupt, and it wasn't just the city government that was going bankrupt. Lots of things were just sort of, the wheels were coming off. And in cuisine, there were just nothing much great was going on. And that's, suddenly the prevailing winds started coming over from California, and counter winds coming over from the nouvelle cuisine people over in France, and it created this great storm center over New York as people started picking up on new ideas. And physically, I mean, people from California came to New York to show what was going on and to open some eyes. I mean, it was just a series of mind-blowing experiences for food writers in New York when there would be these kind of demonstration dinners when chefs from L.A. and from Alice Waters and her crew would come over and show what they were up to. And that was, those were big moments for journalists who were on the food beat.
And what were some of the first chefs who started rising out of that, out of this new wind and restaurants?
Well, the River Cafe has always been, is one restaurant that seemed to generate just one chef after another. I mean, this is long, the alumni association must be, it's enormous at this point. From Larry Forgione and Charlie Palmer and this one and that one. Dozens have just spread out and all started their own restaurants. And lower down in the city, Alfred Portale at Gotham Bar and Grill, which is still a good restaurant. It's still going on. Those guys, it's funny, I was listening to Andre Sultner was on the radio, and he was talking about when he got to New York and opened in the early 60s, his restaurant, Lutece. He said, the only fresh herb I could get was parsley. I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, and that just is a conversation stopper right there. And I talked to Alfred Portale. He said, what was the scene like in the early 80s? And they were scrambling right, left, and center to get the kind of ingredients that were exciting people in California and that you just couldn't access in New York. You had to make special arrangements, and everything was by hook and by crook. They were all just inventing it as they went along.
I remember my first time you know, as a teenager going to Boulay in Tribeca, I guess, when it had just opened. And, you know, I'd heard about it as, you know, the great New York restaurant, at least at the moment. And you're walking down the aisles and you're seeing these crates of, there was a long entrance into the restaurant itself, and you see these crates of produce. And the produce was the stuff that wasn't quite good enough to make it into like Vons and Ralphs that made it into the kind of the, you know, it was the brands that you'd see in East LA here. And you go here and a lot of the preparations were exquisite, but if you're making tomato water, which was, I guess, his invention, where you put tomatoes in a little salt, you let it drip, and it's very clear, and it has a concentrated flavor. But if you're using the kind of tomatoes that he was using, it wasn't quite what
the dish could be. I remember being a teenager and going back east and wanting to order salad, because for me, it wasn't a meal unless mm-hmm. I had a salad. And my mother's like practically hitting my hands, hitting the menu on my hands, like, no, just don't do that. And I'm like, why? I don't understand. She said, go ahead. And, you know, it looks like a truck ran over it, or it like sat out in the sun for a long time. So let's talk about this period of time. Mm-hmm. The 80s, when for the first time one started to feel that there was a race between New York and California in terms of chefs and restaurants and cuisine and what is real and what is worth following.
Well, Los Angeles, I keep thinking of around 1984, the time of the Olympics, where the attention of the world was focused on the city, on the city's restaurant scene, where the first Gomio Guide came out, the first edition of it in Los Angeles, I would submit, is probably the first really, really good restaurant guide, I mean, critical restaurant guide that ever existed in Los Angeles, you know, Pache, Paul Wallach, or whatever. And so suddenly you had all these people doing these interesting things. A lot of it was influenced, obviously, by the Nouvelle Cuisine in France. A lot of it was influenced by the sort of like marvelous ingredients that people were just starting to grow. I mean, you know, you ran an Italian restaurant in the 80s. You remember the days before you could actually get basil?
Yeah, I mean, when I first opened, like a couple of years before I opened my restaurant, you couldn't get basil. It was just parsley still. Yeah. Like in the very early 80s.
And, you know, I mean, Valentino served pesto, and it was this miraculous dish that nobody had ever seen before.
Yep.
That seems like a really long time ago.
It was a really long time ago.
And, you know, I would say probably, you know, Mame's Own and the sort of casual idea of dining, the idea that you could be eating the best food in the world, or available at the time, but you'd be sitting on a lawn chair at a table that was probably bought from Cost Plus because they couldn't afford to buy a better one, was something that I think spread across the country, you know, really quickly, to the point where I think by 1985, 1986, you could go and find the same sort of, you know, crawfish pizza with you know, buffalo mozzarella and andouille in Dayton, Ohio, at a Holiday Inn. I mean, the idea of the ingredient driven food, the idea of the availability of fresh herbs, and of course, at the point where people started to realize that they lived in Los Angeles, which was not necessarily a monochromatic city. It was no longer the Iowa by the Sea that it was called in the 30s. And that, in fact, the best ducks were to be found in Chinatown. And the best squabs were to be found elsewhere. And there were, like, you know, amazing, you know, Islamic butchers who would give you much higher quality meat than you were getting, you know, through usually supply routes. And the sort of, you know, herbs and Middle Eastern things you were getting from the, you know, Armenian and Middle Eastern markets that were winding up. And it was like the entire world on a plate, which seemed like a miracle at a time, and in a way it almost still does.
Yeah, I think the story, I mean, I think it's a story that's reiterated in different places with slightly different inflections, but the big story is the same for everybody. It's sort of the declining prestige of French cuisine, the increasing prestige of Asian cuisines and of Latin American cuisines, localitis in the best sense, that is, people just suddenly realizing that what they have around them is worth seeking out and inquiring into, a certain amount of historical reclamation is worth going after. At the same time, you know, technologically, all of this is, to me, is a way of trying to repair the ravages of an industrialized food program in the United States, which is like an acid bath for genuine regional cuisines. You can't have them unless you have regional ingredients, and to have that, you have to have a long, slow development process where people find out what grows the best where, which the French have been able to do, and that's why there's a specific area where the prunes are just the best in the world, and the specific area where the strawberries are better than anywhere else. And in here, we're doing this kind of ongoing rearguard action to reconstruct the market. Like, if we could get the Fulton Market back, how great would that be? Or the Washington Market back?
It's inconceivable now, from where we sit, that ever went away.
I know. But it does all the time. Look at the buildings that went away also. I mean, in architecture, the same sorts of things happen. But, I mean, on the plus side, being able to get these ingredients, you had this internationalization of the way chefs are trained and their career experience. So you have a guy like Jean-Georges Van Gerichten going to Bangkok, and suddenly he's shopping the markets over there and putting all sorts of equations together that never would have occurred to him had he stayed in France. And jet travel is making it possible for a lot of these market ingredients he sees to get back to him in New York in a matter of, you know, 24 hours. So a lot of the scrambling that people were doing in a very, sort of on the fly back in the early 80s became much more systematized as people got set up who dealt in specialized seafood products and specialized this and that, and the air freight could get it all to everybody at all times.
You had an interesting passage in your book about, I suppose it was your first review for the Times, where you went to Larry Forgione's remaking of The Coach House.
Yeah.
And, you know, Forgione is a chef that I think both of us respect a great deal, and he was the one who was sort of at the forefront of American food as American food, the heir to James Beard as much as anybody else was. But you said when you went to the restaurant, and I completely agree with you at that particular restaurant, that it seemed really old-fashioned. Could you talk about that a bit?
Well, The Coach House, now here's, you know, people... The original Coach House, which is in where Babbo is now, but it was a beloved institution in New York, and it predates me, so I'm sort of like tiptoeing here. But it was the owner was Greek, but he had this reverence for American food, and he presented it at the Coach House, and apparently it was just at a very high level of kind of genuine James Beardish kind of dishes. And you know, it lived its appointed hour and then withdrew from the scene. I don't remember why it went out of business exactly, but it had been out of business for decades, and they tried to redo it in a different location, and they brought Larry Forgione in, who seemed, that was a logical choice of chef, sort of the king of this new American James Beard-influenced kind of cooking. And he tried to redo it there, and it just... You can't reheat a souffle, they often say, and that seemed to be the case here. There were these certain these corn sticks that he did that were the Madeleines for a lot of New Yorkers who had eaten them at the Coach House, and they were really good. And a lot of what he was doing at that restaurant was really good, and it just seemed like you just can't do it twice. And I think that was the case there, and the location was awful. I mean, it was just a very strange block.
Let's cut to today.
Okay.
I think what's happening now in both cities, maybe I'm thinking more Brooklyn, the youth, the 20 and 30-year-olds who are just coming up and embracing food, whole hog, super rear guard action, starting out from wanting everything, the best ingredients, totally local, learning how to do everything themselves from bacon to chocolate, and and serving it in unpretentious, accessible environments, which is happening here too.
That's the next wave, I think.
It's our savior, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the thing you'd sort of thing you'd expect me to say, but I think a lot of it has to do with the way that a lot of younger people grew up today, through the influence of punk rock. And it sounds
it sounds
odd, but there was this huge movement that. There was a magazine called Maxim Rock and Roll that was sort of its Bible, but where everybody, you know, lived together communally, where nobody would, where you wouldn't eat meat. They were all vegan. They're not vegan anymore. They like breaking down their own hogs, which is possibly farther than most people want to go. But
the DIY ethos.
But the do it yourself. The idea that anything worth doing is worth doing yourself, and that you want to stay as far away from the corporate people who do not wish the best for you as you possibly can. And I've got to admit, I found it sort of touching and sweet the first tentative waves of this, and now it's here with a vengeance. And I think it's amazing. I think a lot of the food is amazing. And as soon as people start getting out of the current phase of restaurants being more about shopping than they are actually about cooking what you find, then...
What do you mean by that?
I mean, there are a lot of restaurants that I consider part of that movement that will go and they will source exquisite stuff from, I mean, exquisite produce from the farmer's market, and they will go out of their way to find, you know, beautiful, sustainably raised meat, and they'll, you know, mail order or smuggle in their suitcase, you know, the proper condiments from Austria or Italy, and then they'll just put today's shopping list on a plate with a couple hazelnuts for crunch.
a lack of culinary prowess.
Well, I don't know lack of culinary prowess. I think it's that they're so in awe of the ingredients that they've worked so hard to get that they just they're more obsessed with not fucking them up than they are with doing anything great with them.
What do you think?
Yeah, I
pardon my friend.
Yeah, that all sounds right. This intensely personal kind of garage band. You know, David. I haven't eaten at any of David Chang's restaurants, but he strikes to me. It seems to me that he's. Sort of the man of the moment, and that way of thinking about doing a restaurant with about 8 tables and no reservations.
For people who are not that in touch with New York, what are his restaurants?
Well, let's see. What are they? There's about 4 of them now, and Momofuku. There's a little bakery offshoot of Momofuku, and what are the other ones? Probably the people out there know.
There's Ko, and there's the Sambar.
Yeah, so
and Ko is the one that you can't get into unless you're friends with a hacker who can figure out how to game the reservation system. And then the bakery's called Milk Bar, I think. And there's some great stuff in there, and there's some just god awful stuff in there.
Yeah, my wife goes running in there, and she comes out with some cookies that she loves, and it's. You got to get your mind around some of those cookies. I decided they're good, but it took me long moments of sober reflection to.
Wow! I can't imagine a cookie that would take moments of sober reflection.
Well, it is a little. There's lots to think about, and and who would have suspected that from a simple little cookie? But I think the whole ethos, the thing. The way he goes at it, and I think people in France are doing this sort of thing too, Pascal Barbeau, people turning in their Michelin stars and saying, screw it, setting up a place in the 99th arrondissement and where, you know, you just can't possibly know about it, but there it is and it's greater than anything. So I think, you know, there's a real, you feel like there's a change in the air that's veering toward these kind of highly personal statement kind of restaurants.
It's interesting. It's an interesting time.
And also towards extreme statements of carnivorous intent.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you wonder, where were all the duck hearts before this year?
Yeah, the meat thing, maybe it started with the nose-to-tail guy and came over here from him.
I think it's a reaction to the other parts of their generation, which are the vegan parts.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there are a lot of people who just, the thing they really want to do is get their hands on a whole steer or hog and break it down.
I'd like to do that.
don't the offers come into your email box like three times a day, the offers to buy like, you know, 1/8 of a beautifully raised steer, and they warn it will take up every square inch of room in your freezer, but what else were you going to do with it?
Yeah.
I suppose if you guys have Ife machine, maybe they're right.
Isn't that what Bill Buford is doing now? Is he being like hog butcher to the world or something? I thought that for his next book he was doing some sort of apprentice butcher.
That makes sense. It's that there are people who aren't at home unless they have their arms up a pig.
And on that note, why don't we open up for some questions? Right here, dead center.
Thank you. My question has to do with the growing trend of food on wheels here in Los Angeles, and I wonder, what do you see as the evolution of that trend here in Los Angeles, and maybe as well if you can speak to what you see in New York?
I suppose speaking to the Los Angeles part, I mean, we've always had taco trucks. I mean, millions of taco trucks, really, really good taco trucks that park in particular locations. And you know, if you like the way that this person, you know, fries the trompas, that's where you're going to go. If you like the way this person does carnitas, that's where you're going to go. The new thing that you're talking about started here, obviously, with the Kogi truck. And they were so good at using social media. I mean, their blog, of course, but mostly Twitter, that it made everybody who went to it seem like a part of a party. And you get a tweet telling you where to go, where you'd probably meet 20 of your friends, and you'd drive all the way from Hollywood to Rosemead because you knew that there'd be something groovy happening from, you know, 1 until 4.
Why can't they just come to Hollywood?
They do it. well, now there are 4 Kogi trucks, and one of them is often in Hollywood. And the guy who did Kogi, Roy Choi, he was first in his class in the CIA. He was the
Culinary Institute of America.
We're not talking chefs, not spooks. And was the executive chef at the Beverly Hilton Hotel and I think the Beverly Wilshire at some point, which means that he knows how to do banquets and he knows how to serve 1,500 people. And that sort of timing and that sort of organization proved very useful to him when, in fact, he did have to serve the 1,500 people that showed up to eat from his truck. Now there are 20 or 30 or 40 other trucks around, none of which are as accomplished. The Border Grill truck is great. There's a couple that are pretty good, but mostly they're sort of people following the trend because they sense that there's a lot of money being made. They see Twitter being free and groovy, and frankly, the quality of food and the level of organization isn't such. That being said, there's a great truck scene in Portland. There's some very good,
amazing.
There's some very good trucks in New York. San Francisco has a few. I don't see them going away anyway, too. It's like it's entry-level capitalism, but it's very most entry-level. All you need is a few hundred bucks to rent a truck.
Yeah, we don't have so many trucks. I mean, traffic there are certain difficulties in Manhattan to doing a truck thing. But moving food, I mean, if you go back to those markets I was talking about from the very earliest days, there was mobile food everywhere. Sometimes it was, you know, a big coffee canister strapped to somebody's back, and the strolling pie vendors were swarming all over these markets. And
I have to interrupt you for a moment, because your sentence in the book that said in 1895, New Yorkers ate 22 million pies just floored me.
It was, that was lunch, that was the lunch for just thousands and thousands of New Yorkers. It was a cup of coffee and a slice or two of pie. And they had these pie, the pie factories were just generating untold numbers of pies in all different flavors. And one thing I have to say for the infamous Jay Gould was one of his railroad lines extended, he extended it deep into prime huckleberry territory, and all of a sudden New York had was suddenly getting some of the greatest huckleberry pies it had ever tasted. So they couldn't quite hate him as much as they should have, because, you know, those pies were just too good to ignore. But the generally New York's always been sort of a food sidewalk food cart kind of place, much more than a mobile in the street food. So there's, I think that's been in place throughout New York history, and it's really going great guns at the moment. I think street food has got this, there's a whole cult-like thing going on a lot of the street food.
I think economically, too, it really hits the spot right now.
Yes, indeed.
Except the dosa stand in New York is really good, and the dosa truck here...
Yeah, well.
They're doses.
Man in white shirt.
I'm hopeful each of our guests might share a few moments from their most memorable restaurant meal.
Yeah, that's good. Please.
Okay. Well, I don't really keep them in my...
Recently.
Memory. I don't keep... Well, you know, there are certain dishes that sort of stand out and I can't forget them, like the oxtail foie gras terrine at Restaurant Daniel. I always thought that was an index to his whole sensibility, this kind of high-low fusion in his temperament. He's from Lyon, and so he likes it rich, and he likes it down-to-earth and also rarefied, and that little slice of heaven was something that sticks with me. The you know, memorable meals are often memorable for me by their length and sort of by the fatigue with which I leave the restaurant. There's a whole list of those. Boulay served one up to me not too long ago that was, he's taken a very Japanese turn in his cooking, and he's much more into sort of smaller portions and many of them, and I think this was like a 25 part tasting menu, and you know, it was a real beg for mercy menu at the end.
Okay, I'll go with one of my favorite restaurants in Italy, which I think actually the owner may have died last year, so I'm sorry about that, but it's a country restaurant about a half hour north of Arezzo, and he grows sort of bad Chianti in the fields. And you go in, and there's a lean-to with chickens pecking at your feet and big, long wooden tables. And you start with this antipasto that, like, runs the length of a football field with all the pleasures of the Tuscan table, you know, the marinated peppers, the tiny anchovies caught from the Mediterranean, the little octopus, roasted tomatoes that for an extra $2 you get roast prosciutto, spiced prosciutto carved off the bone. And you keep eating that, then you sit down, and they bring you like some homemade, cavatelli probably with boar ragu from a boar that the owner had shot, and then the guy comes out looking, you know, big and hulking, with a blood-stained apron, you know, presenting this gigantic fiorentina that he'd cooked in his fireplace, and he hacks it with something that looks like a machete, and blood runs down your chin, and there you
go. And what's it called?
It was called Osteria di Costa Chiara.
Nice.
You need to serve that at your restaurant.
This lovely young woman here.
Hi. Jonathan, you spent a lot of time writing about the hole in the wall, the strip mall, the great Korean restaurant that serves a fantastic goat stew next to the laundromat and the check cashing place. I wonder if you could talk about that style of restaurant in both cities.
Los Angeles is a great city for, I guess, what I just called entry-level capitalism, for people who come and who come to the country and they may have been chefs in their home countries and may not have been, but they settle in a mini mall and they buy, you know, all the decor and all the restaurant equipment probably one day used, and your elbows stick to the table, but often they have, like, you know, one or two or three or ten just amazing recipes that you'll go back and back and back for, because they're, the way Los Angeles is set up, it's a very inward-looking town, so that in large parts of it you have Chinese cooking for Chinese and Koreans cooking for Koreans and Oaxacans cooking for Oaxacans without any thought that anybody that isn't, you know, part of their group would come and eat the food. So there's a certain, I hate to use the word purity, but there's a certain, like, clarity to the cooking, because it's not compromised by they're trying to anticipate what you, somebody not of that group, is going to want from their food. It becomes less a game of family feud than it does, you know, eating the same food, the same stew that, like, Mr. Kim ate every Thursday when he was growing up in Seoul and really wants to eat when he goes to this restaurant. And it's there and it's the same form. New York, because it's denser, because everybody takes the subways together, because everybody walks down the same streets, because it would be impossible to live in Manhattan, ignore the fact that there is a 32nd Street with, 50 Korean restaurants on it. The restaurateurs do actually anticipate what people who are not of their groups might want from a restaurant. And so there are many wonderful, wonderful places to eat in New York, and the restaurants at a certain level are probably the best, better than they are anywhere in the world. Certainly than in the country, but on the sort of, you know, next door to the laundromat level, we do better, I think, even in Queens.
Yeah, I don't know enough about L.A. to, that strikes me as probably true, I because what you're describing, I was thinking, well, gee, I can't think of all that many examples of that in New York. I mean, if you go out to Flushing, there's some kind of interesting stuff, and I remember the first time somebody introduced me to this little kind of arcade underneath the Manhattan Bridge where if you push past the cheap jewelry stands up front and you go to the back, there's like five laborers sitting around, and there suddenly you can find that there's this little operation where they're turning out these seeded buns with braised mustard greens stuffed with, you know, stuffed into the bun, and nobody speaks any English. And I don't think they're looking for, they were not expecting somebody like me to be buying the buns. Mm-hmm. Definitely, but there's not a lot of that.
I mean, one of my best friends is, you know, Robert Sietsma, who mm-hmm. probably, and he's always the guy he's the restaurant critic for the Village Voice, and his obsessions are probably close to my own. And he never thinks a restaurant's worth going to unless you take two trains and at least three buses to get there, which means you're always going for the one Kazakh bread store in Mill Basin or something.
Yeah, you have to. You definitely have to take a long train ride to get to what you're talking about.
So you mentioned a few of your brief highlights in eating, and I was wondering if you could talk about some terrible, awful experiences you've had, the worst. Or you have a choice, or you can maybe talk. I was wondering if there's some kind of food equivalent to a snuff film, something forbidden. And I don't know the answer to this, but you have a choice. You can talk about either.
That's good.
Well, let's see.
Those 25 course meals might be the food equivalent.
Or there are those certain restaurants where you see every single course alive before you eat it.
Yeah, the Eddie Lin restaurant.
Well, as far as just bad food, it all kind of merges in the mind into just one sort of repeat nightmare, and it's hard to, it's really hard for me to. I did this article once called "Restaurants That Time Forgot," and there is this category of restaurant in New York where you drive by and you think, how can that place possibly still be in business? So the answer is always because they own the building. And so it was that I walked into the just old relic of a German restaurant called Rolf's, and it's just as German food when it's bad is just hard to beat for bad. And that's what they specialized in.
Have you been to the one in the cemetery in Queens, the German restaurant?
No, I haven't. Oh,
it's special. Not only is the food bad, but there's taxidermy on the wall, and you're in the middle of a cemetery. People are dying to get in.
And I live in Astoria, which is this, sort of outside of Greece. It seems to be the biggest, I don't know if it's the biggest Greek city outside of Greece, but anybody Greek knows what Astoria is. And so there's a romance about it among Manhattanites who don't live there but have just heard about it and say, oh, you live in Astoria, that's wonderful, because all these wonderful Greek restaurants. Let me tell you, Greek restaurants come in the same gradations as every other, good, bad, and indifferent. And there's a lot of really, really bad Greek restaurants in Astoria, just this steam table stuff that people romanticize because they go out there and they think, oppa, and they hear the bouzouki music and they get excited and they don't notice that the potatoes just are squishy and mealy and the lamb has been sitting there for 9 hours. And
which makes me wonder, have either of you ever gotten food poisoning from a restaurant that you were reviewing?
Yeah.
I don't think I have.
You often eat higher on the food chain than I do.
I think that, right. I mean, it was sort of divvied up at the times. So there was the 25 and under guy, and then I tended to hit the higher food, higher up the food chain, as you say.
What do you make of this new trend towards sort of interesting food that is meant to taste like the real thing, but in fact is like Jell-O and looks like nothing like what it actually is supposed to taste like?
The molecular gastronomy.
Yeah, uh-huh, that uh-huh. El Bulli stuff.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just absolutely wonderful, although you end up thinking, why? Is this because... Did this have to be done? Mm-hmm. Are they doing it just to show that it can be done? And a lot of times they are. I mean, it's haute couture food, and it has some of the functions of haute couture, which is to show, to inspire, to dazzle, to terrify, to show what can be done, and without the understanding that people are seriously, literally going to put this food on a menu, but rather they're going to sort of break it apart and take ideas from it and do things. Of course, a lot of what they do is then incredibly stupid. And I lived through the whole foam phase when I was the reviewer, and it's just a lot of that was really, really pointless. But some of it is, in the right hands. I don't think it's going to be the next thing, but...
Well, it was
aspects of it are going to be used,
It was the next thing. It's last year's next thing. This year's thing is apparently slaughtering your own hog. Mm-hmm.
As a permanent contribution, I don't think it's going to have the weight of, say, Nouvelle Cuisine or some of these, or New American or any of that. But I think we're still in the midst of it. The jury's out. Maybe I'll whistle a different tune in another 5 years.
The thing that's interesting, though, is the embrace of certain technological equipment that allows restaurants to deal with food in ways that they weren't able to before. That seems like it's really entered in a big way.
Oh, yeah. If there were no sous vide,
right.
Then like half the restaurants in Manhattan would have to go out of business.
Yeah, that's, you brought up the one thing that's worth pondering at length, which is sous vide cooking. And that's really different, and it's really new, and a lot of it's just really, the results are just stupendous in a lot of cases.
And in some cases, you really don't want lamb that's the same texture all the way throughout. I like a little bit more variety in my food than it tends to have.
But. Okay, went back, way in the back.
Jonathan Gold, I remember a few years ago in the LA Weekly, you were reviewing a sushi restaurant, and you had this great line about how there was an inverse relationship between the quality of the sushi and the awfulness of the music that was playing in the restaurant. And for both of you, I was wondering if you had any other sort of counterintuitive rules of thumb in your years of critics, of being critics, that you've come up with.
The bigger the pepper mill, the worse the restaurant.
That's a good one.
Do you have another one besides me?
No, I'm still marveling at the peppermint comment.
Okay, one more. Way in the back.
Do you dine anonymously when you were reviewing?
Yes, I endeavored to dine anonymously, and all the forces of nature and human ingenuity were conspiring to deprive me of that experience, but the intent was to dine anonymously.
The same here. I was reviewing at Gourmet at the same time he was reviewing at the New York Times, and often we were both reviewing anonymously in the same room, and we were giving the same anonymous treatment by the waiters. It was sort of interesting to see.
That would be, I mean, that's like the donkey stuck between two bales of hay, because if you're a waiter and you got this guy and this guy, and you're sort of... Which four waiters do we send to fill the guy's water glass? You know? He's only got three guys filling his water glass.
And usually when you are recognized or you know that you're being rushed, it's not that the food's better, it's that the waiter's hand shakes when he's pouring the wine.
Now, that is so sad. I did see people tremble, and I thought, you know, it's not necessary. It's just, you know, have a little confidence that you've got to, you know, you're doing good work here, and let's all
or
relax.
Not. Well, I think the time has come for us to bid each other adieu. Thank you very much for coming. I want to thank the library, Justin and Louise.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.